Welcome, my name is Andrew Gregson. In today's special edition of Chamber Talk, we are talking to a candidate who is running for California's 46th Congressional District. So, ladies and gentlemen, please allow me to introduce a compelling individual shaped by the American dream. Born to a Taiwanese immigrant in the 1960s, amongst the racial challenges that we had in the days, our guest's upbringing installed values of resilience, hard work, and integrity. Educated in Chicago and later in Stanford and Columbia, our guest David Pan, now a UC Irvine professor, witnessed the shaping landscape of academia. Concerned about straying from merit and equal opportunity, he's transitioned to politics, or transitioning to politics. David is a member of the Republican Party and is running for the election to the U.S. House of Representatives, California's 46th Congressional District. And beyond academia, David has served as a management consultant for McKinsey. Apologize if I got that wrong. Edited journal Telos, and been a commissioner for the Unalienable Rights at the U.S. State Department. And he's committed and feels responsible to reflect on the profound belief in addressing our nation's critical issues. Welcome to today's show, David. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy.
So where was your drive from today? Where did you come back up here to Buena Park?
Oh, the UC Irvine campus.
So all right, okay.
That's where I work.
Did you have a class this morning?
I did not.
Okay. You didn't just do your classes. All right. So we're going to start with an easy question. We're going to do a little bit of an introduction. So if you could please just sort of like say a few words or introduce yourself and provide a brief overview of your background.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the question. So, like you said, you know, I grew up in Chicago to an immigrant family. I was born there in Chicago, though, and I went into in college. I went into German literature. That's my background, and I'm a professor of German literature now. But sort of along the way, I've done some other things. You know, I spent some time in Germany, like on a junior year abroad program and on fellowships. Like you said, I worked as a management consultant for a couple of years, and I did this sort of brief, it was like a year-long thing at the State Department. that was, you know, it wasn't a regular position, I was just a commissioner. I've been involved, though, in lots of different sort of intellectual debates about politics, about political theory, and about kind of thinking through, you know, the best way government can relate to people, but on a kind of academic level.
And whereabouts in Germany did you stay?
Different places. You know, when I was in college, I went to Freiburg, which is in the southwestern corner. I've spent a lot of time in Berlin. Spent a lot of time in Konstanz, also in the south of Germany.
So what first motivated you then to sort of run for Congress?
So, you know, things at the university have really changed in the time I've been there. I mean, I've been teaching at UC Irvine this coming up on 18 years. And, you know, one of the things that's really happened is that the ideological kind of perspective there has really narrowed a lot. I mean, we all know this, right? I mean, there are hardly any Republicans at the university. And I was, in fact, until about about a year ago, I was registered as a Democrat. Mm. I considered myself, I guess, a relative conservative Democrat, but I was still in part of the Democratic Party. Not only the Democratic Party, but I feel like the university has just shifted so much to the left, and the ideological positions on the right are not represented at all, right? That there's just not much you can do at the university anymore in terms of having a real debate about issues that are kind of front and center in kind of mainstream politics, right? Mm. It's just so, you know, there's no space for Republicans, or no space certainly for Trump supporters, where you can actually have a fair hearing, mm-hmm. At the university level. So that's why I felt I needed, if I were going to represent these types of ideas that are, I mean, I guess relatively conservative, I needed to step out of the university.
So That's a great point that you just mentioned there, and a lot of our listeners might not quite understand that there is also politics within a university. So do you mind sharing some of the challenges, that you, the topic challenges that you mean by you're unable to sort of have a different view on things?
Right. Well, I mean, the key one has been about the diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. So those policies, I really consider them to be discriminatory. In fact, the sort of incident that really kind of, for me, kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back was I was closely involved with a search committee. This is our department. I'm a German professor in the Department of European Language and Studies, and we were searching for a French professor. And what happens now, and this was not the case whatever 15 years ago, is that every single search now has to be approved by what they call an equity advisor, right?
Okay.
So that has to approve the search in terms of these diversity and equity goals. And one of the things that happened, the search media had come up with a short list of candidates. It was three candidates. And the equity advisor had said, it doesn't have the right kind of minority and women composition in this shortlist, right?
Okay.
We're going to cancel your search unless you bring people from farther down the list and put them in your shortlist. Right?
So if I'm understanding this correctly in my non-academia world, does that basically mean that they may be, rather than looking for the best candidate, you're looking to figure out other checks in the boxes, or is that...
Yes, exactly. Right.
Oh, okay.
That if you don't have enough, I mean, clearly it was about blacks, Hispanics, and women.
Right.
And if you didn't have enough in your shortlist, they said we're going to cancel the search unless you bring in more of those people farther down the list. And frankly speaking, this was a professor of French. I mean, the pool of candidates was not large.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It was going to really shrink right down to one person in the world.
Right. So that. Just the number of blacks and Hispanics in our entire pool was just very small.
Right.
And so, for me, this was just a clear case of discrimination, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, though, but there's no way on campus to protest, to say anything against this kind of policy. It's embedded in the entire university structure from the,
So it's like a black and white type thing. You either are or you're not. There's no talking about
it. There's no talking about it at all, because it's embedded in the entire administrative structure of the university, from the office of the president all the way down.
Right.
And so the only thing that we could have, the search committee could have done would have been just to give up and say, okay, we won't hire somebody.
Right.
Right. And so, there really isn't any scope for debate on these issues at the university, right? Because it's embedded in the entire administrative structure.
Do you feel that in some way then, we're moving away from potentially who is the best candidate for the job in this circumstance then?
Undoubtedly. There's no question. I mean, if the criteria are not based on the quality and the merit of the candidates, then obviously you're moving
the wrong way, aren't you? Right. And then you're going to end up changing them again in a very short period of time, I suppose. So, could you share some key experiences from your own personal journey that you feel have shaped you in order to be a congressman?
I think one of the biggest things that I've kind of learned in academia is to not be afraid to say what you believe.
Mm.
And that's something that I think is difficult for lots of academics these days, but always been. So I've had problems because in the past, so when I was starting out as an assistant professor, I was exploring all sorts of different conservative thinkers in Germany.
Okay.
Right, so there's like these, before the Nazis came to power, there's a whole thing called the conservative revolution in Germany. All these different conservative thinkers, Nazis among them, and I was exploring some of these. And this is a research topic. It's like, what's going on there? There was an incredible kind of, they called it the conservative revolution. It was a kind of ferment in Germany amongst the conservatives. And I was interested in that. I was studying that. Not only that, I mean, I wrote on lots of different German topics. I've written on Kafka, probably, and don't know, other writers are Kleist. And anyway, but you know, I had trouble because people complained that I was writing about these, you know, some of them were Nazis later on or something, you know, or, you know, definitely conservatives. And they're like, you know, what are you doing thinking about this stuff?
Right,
and,
right.
But, you know, this is a legitimate intellectual task to understand conservative movements. And, you know, some of them had good ideas. I mean, one of the, you know, and but I stuck to what I was doing.
Of course.
Right? And so, and it had, you know, there was some bad consequences for me professionally in the mm-hmm. beginning because of that, but ultimately, you know, I think it enhanced my sense of what I was doing, and also I think the value that I was bringing to intellectual debates, that I was really doing something nobody else was doing, right? And kind of coming to some insights that other people weren't, because they had avoided these topics. So I guess, you know, what I'd hope, right, is that, you know, if I'm a politician, I'm in Congress, that I'll continue to be, you know, really not afraid to say what I think, if I really believe in the values at stake, and kind of accept those consequences, and hopefully I can get through that in the sense that if what I'm saying has value, that people will recognize that.
So what kind of issues do you see most critical in the community that you'd be serving in the 46th district? Mm-hmm.
So I think the main issues are about affordability, you know, housing affordability, inflation, gas prices. I think that's really front and center for a lot of the people in this district. I mean, the district is, you know, has a comparatively low median household income compared to the rest of Orange County. 65% are Hispanic, and another, like, almost 13% is Vietnamese, so a lot of immigrants. I think people struggle with affordability, and that's really what I want to address.
And have you already thought about some of these things, what you would do, or is it sort
of... Oh, yes.
Would you mind sharing a few of your ideas there, or just at least the bullet points of them?
Right. Well, so... You know, one of the other reasons I went into politics is because I had this idea as an academic, or I had read about this idea that I thought it was great, and I was trying to promote it as an academic and didn't get very far. And the idea is basically to take the idea is that our current system of welfare and entitlements is not working for us. And what I'd like to do is take all of the welfare and entitlement programs, and this would include like things like food stamps and student loans and the housing vouchers and Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, all of that, and I want to phase it all out and replace it all with a universal basic income. It works out to $16,000 a year for everybody 21 years of age or older for the rest of their lives. And so it's basically taking all this money that we're spending, it's like over $4 trillion a year in the federal budget, it's over half the federal budget, and just basically, I mean, we'll phase it out over time, grandfather in people who are on Social Security or even within 30 years of retirement and just let them stay with the existing plan of benefits if they choose, but basically, you know, gradually then shift over to this new system where we're taking that $4 trillion, dissolving it into cash, and just depositing it into people's bank accounts directly on this kind of a universal basis. And you know, I think the big advantage, several advantages of this plan is it's based on equality. Everybody's going to get the same. It's based on promoting work, which is to say that right now our current welfare system creates these disincentives to work, because once you start to work, once you build up assets, you lose the benefits, right? So it's kind of constraining people to not work, whereas my plan would give the same benefits to working people and to non-working people, so there's no disincentive to work at all. And I think the people that gain the most from my plan are, in fact, the working poor, right? People who have jobs that really that don't earn that much money. And because they would get this full benefit, right? And finally, you know, because our current system is so real wasteful, actually, with my plan, we're actually going to save, I've calculated something like $800 billion a year over what we're doing now. So mm-hmm. I'm taking that $4 trillion a year, and I'm actually taking, we're going to take it to like $3.2 trillion, and that's the money it's going to get distributed to everybody, but the $800 billion, that can go toward reducing our deficit.
Now, if I may ask you a question, on not questioning you whether your idea is good or not, because I haven't got a clue. I
okay.
wouldn't be able to answer.
Okay.
I certainly haven't sat here and studied it. But one thing you mentioned, you said obviously you would remove things like Medicare and Medicaid and things like that. So what would happen for people who required still the medical services? Is the idea to just buy their own? Or
Well, you're getting into some of the details of this plan. So of the $16,000 a year, I would take $4,000 a year, and that would be dedicated to a health insurance voucher. Right? So the plan would consist of $1,000 a month deposited directly into people's bank accounts, but then $4,000 a year as of this health insurance voucher. Now, the voucher would be $4,000 a year. Right now on the health insurance markets, it's enough to buy an individual catastrophic plan.
Yeah,
it's a catastrophic plan.
Yeah.
And the advantage here is that, people could obviously pay more to get a better plan.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will, they already have a health insurance plan, and this would just basically go toward paying that, so they would save that money. And so, but for people that don't have insurance and need insurance, this would be a plan, and especially this is good for young people. This is a plan that allows them to spend the least amount of money on a sort of regular basis, right? But it creates a whole market for health care services in which you just have doctors and patients relating to each other, because such plans have generally an $8,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
So for big events, you're covered, kind of like with car insurance.
Right.
But for day-to-day events, you break your arm, you have a cut or something like that, you'll be just going to a doctor and negotiating directly with the doctor for services without insurance companies, government getting in the way.
Mm.
This will, I think, create an overall control on costs in our healthcare system as a whole. Because the big problem right now we have in our healthcare system is that overall, the people that are benefiting from the care are not paying for the care, and there's no control on the costs. And so we have a system in which we send a larger percentage of GDP on healthcare than any other country in the world, but we don't have the improved outcomes to show for that, right? So, so this part of this plan it's universal coverage, but it's private, right? So Medicare and Medicaid ultimately I would be privatizing.
Mm-hmm.
There's
a lot you have to do, especially now when you're campaigning, and then you're going against an incumbent who's been in the job for some number of years now. So what type of community engagement have you actually been doing over the last several months or so? Mm-hmm. What have you been up to?
Well, the main thing is I've been knocking on doors, talking to voters, but I've also been working with the schools in the district and engaging young people, especially the high school students and the college students, and engaging them as interns in my campaign. And part of that has been kind of training them and kind of lecturing to them speaking to them about our system of government and about my ideas also for changing it. And then I've been working with them to canvass the district. And so that's the main thing, really working with individual voters and schools. That's kind of a continuation of my whole education interest in my background. But I guess I'm kind of intensifying that in the sense I'm really trying to reach a much broader base of people.
And for our audience, because not everybody will know this, when you're campaigning like this, do you work alongside other folks who are running for certain government, seats, whether it's assembly or state? I mean, do you work together within the party, or is it just literally you're on your own for a little bit?
Well, so I am endorsed by the Orange County Republican Party, and I've been, working with them in order to get the endorsement also, but, working with them to get support. I started out when I first decided I wanted to run for office, or was thinking about it. I participated in this program that the Orange County Republican Party has called the Run Red program, where they do these essentially these workshops or these crash courses on how to be a candidate. And I participated in this in last July.
All right.
And I've been working with other people in the Orange County GOP since then on my campaign. I've gotten a lot of support. Particularly Councilwoman Rhonda Shader from Placentia.
Oh, yes.
and
she was a past chair of the chamber, by the way.
Oh, right. Well, she's been a big supporter, and she ran for Senate in that.
Yeah,
in this area.
Yes, she did. Yeah.
Right, and she's planning on running for Senate, a state Senate again, and so she's been really supportive, and you know, she's been a big help.
So, David, as we're talking today, I was wondering, what's your approach towards collaboration and bipartisanship?
So, you know, my platform, based on the idea of phasing out welfare and entitlement programs, but also on universal basic income, takes a Republican Party imperative, really, about reducing the size and scope of government, but pairs it up with a Democratic Party idea of universal basic income. Mm-hmm. So my platform really depends upon bipartisan support. There's no way that it's obviously, it would be a radical change in the way our government works, but it can only happen if both Democrats and Republicans are on board with this. So from the very beginning, the whole idea of me running is really to try and bring together a coalition of people that are on both sides of the aisle to get around this plan, right? And so, you know, so far, you know, talking to voters, you know, I've gotten a really good response from voters, mm-hmm. right, from both Democrats and Republicans. I've really been inspired by that. What happens is, I think, you know, there are some kind of what you call like the hardliners on both sides, mm-hmm. who resist this idea,
right?
Part of my job is really to try and bring them on board, to convince them of the wisdom of this plan, which, you know, fundamentally is about, you know, I think values that are fun, you know, that are at the basis of the American political system and experience. It's about individual responsibility, right? And so, by giving cash to people, instead of the whole system of government benefits, we're putting the responsibility on individuals to think about their lives, to think about their retirements. But we're also giving them this freedom, mm-hmm. right? I mean, because, you know, rather than channeling it through food stamps and saying, oh, here's some money, but you can only use it for food, right? We're just saying, look, here's some money, do what you want with it. Make your life out of this. So it's about individual freedom and responsibility, which is, I think, it's a you know, these are core American values that I think everybody can get around. It's about, I mean, you know, the reason I'm a Republican, because it is about reducing the size and scope of government. But, I mean, I think those, ultimately, I think that is a core, this is a goal that's core to American values as well. I mean, you know, one writer that I've taught recently is Alexis de Tocqueville, who's, you know, he's a French, but, you know, he wrote Democracy in America, about America, and one of his big insights there was that the United States was built on this idea that you have a strong government, and, you know, in terms of security and safety, but you leave to the people the sort of administration of their daily lives, mm-hmm. right? And I do believe that ultimately that's what the majority of people want. They want that freedom to manage their own lives, right? And this is what this plan would give. And so, you know, my hope, right, is that I can get people on both sides of the aisle to agree to this, and we'll see.
So one of the big things that you mentioned there, which is, you know, it's very important for any government official, is you mentioned the people you've spoken to is, you know, people get it, they understand. Now, what other things are you finding by canvassing? What other things are you learning? What other ideas does the general public have that you might have thought, oh, I didn't know that, or, oh, I'm interested, look into that? Is there anything that stands out in particular?
Well, so, you know, I've been campaigning on this particular message, and one thing that I have learned, which I had kind of suspected, but it's just been reinforced, is that the people that really like my idea are people who work but don't earn a lot of money, right? Because they see, and then they have friends, they have relatives that kind of milk the system, and really are getting away with that in a sense, right? And they're just, I mean, it's a kind of cliche maybe to say that, but it is somewhat true, and I think ultimately the people that are getting these different types of welfare benefits now, they're also constrained too, And they're kind of hemmed in by these different government policies, and it would be freeing for them to just receive cash also. So, that's one thing. Just I'm getting a lot of stories about people who have been kind of frustrated by the system that exists now. You know, I talked to one person who has two sons, one of whom is disabled, and had been receiving these disability benefits. He moved in with his brother, so the brothers moved in together, and this one son lost his benefits because all of a sudden he was in a household, and because the household income exceeded whatever it was, he lost the benefits. So,
right.
So this type of policy, is really so counterproductive. I mean, it makes total sense for the brothers to be living together, right? Mm. But it's like they're prevented from doing that because of these policies. And so, this is the kind of thing that I really want to get rid of. These types of administrative policies that just are sometimes irrational, but in any case, just take away individual freedom and responsibility.
So, David, that's a lot that you're talking about already. Are there any other type of innovative ideas or long-term goals that you've been thinking about that you'd like to set in play?
Yeah. So, the plan that I've set forth addresses a really big issue. But what I've seen recently, or maybe for a while, is that politicians have avoided addressing, the looming crisis with Social Security, the failures of the welfare state. And what I really want to do is just address these big issues that nobody wants to talk about.
Right.
Get them on the agenda, even if you don't like my plan, even if you've got complaints about some details about my plan. I want to have that discussion. I want our Congress to have this discussion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is one of the key ones about the future of Social Security, about our deficits, about the welfare system. I want to have this. I want our politicians and in general to be talking about these vital things that our republic is facing.
Right.
Those are some of the issues. I've got issues about foreign policy that I think that really we really need to discuss. I mean, I think that the world is becoming a much more dangerous place, and the United States really has to, be able to affirm its values in a productive way across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another thing that I really want to make sure that we're addressing soberly, but with a real sense of the risks involved in our future in facing our foreign policy. So,
right.
Yeah.
A lot of things that gets mentioned often right now, because there's a few hot topics, right?
Yeah.
And they sort of fall under the Congress world as well.
Yeah.
Things like immigration and workforce development, things like that, the homeless. You seem to have obviously thought a lot through over your time and before you put your name down to go for Congress. So what are your thoughts and ideas on some of these topics?
I agree, I think, with most Americans that we need to do something about the border. That we obviously can't have an open border. We need to close the border. We need to be able to control immigration into the country. I'm certainly not against immigration, legal immigration, and we need to figure out an appropriate policy for legal immigration, but it obviously can't happen until we have a secure border. I think that most Americans agree with that at this point, and it's just a matter of, navigating Congress to break the logjam on that.
Or having those conversations that you're talking about earlier, those
right.
difficult conversations. Let's just sit down and figure it out. Right,
exactly. Right. I don't know. I mean, I'm just one person, and even
sure.
if I get elected, I'm just again one person.
Exactly.
But hopefully, it starts with a few people, and we can make a change. Right. And we'll see.
And have you thought of anything regarding the homeless situation that we all face
now? Well, I do think that the homeless problem is something that we can't separate from an addiction and mental illness problem. And so we need to have some solutions on addiction and mental illness in order to solve the homeless problem, right? So it's not just about building housing, it's about being able to place people in an environment that'll improve their health. Again, I hope that this idea I have about the universal basic income can help that, because if nobody's born homeless.
No.
Right?
No,
okay?
No,
so
no.
You come from a home, right? Yeah. And what happens is you fall into this situation mm-hmm. because of things in your life. And you know, frankly, you know, you talk to law enforcement, you know, 90% of the people that are in that situation, they have some sort of addiction or mental health issues. And so if we start people off with this universal coverage in health insurance and the universal basic income, everybody's going to have some resources, right, that are dedicated to them as individuals, mm-hmm. right? And if they fall into a situation where they need to be in some kind of long-term treatment, right, this would cover that, mm-hmm. right? This would cover it through their insurance, mm-hmm. right? They would have this $8,000 deductible, mm-hmm. right? But in fact, we're giving them this $1,000 a month that would actually cover the deductible. So if they had to be in a managed care treatment facility, the entire thing could be covered based on the money that they're receiving. It could be done basically on a private level. It could be done based on the resources in the community rather than kind of trying to engineer something from outside, which, you know, so I mean, I think one of the real basic principles that I have is that the people that are best positioned to help other people are the ones closest to the people that need help, mm-hmm. right? Whether mm-hmm. it be the people in the family, mm-hmm. people in the community, churches, whatever, but people that know the people that need help. Mm-hmm. And that's where we need to sort of shift our resources into those people. And that's why the universal basic income, by giving everybody the same amount, everybody's going to have these resources to be able to help themselves, but help each other, right? Rather than channeling it through a bureaucracy, which is never going to be able to understand and be able to manage problems in the best way.
Right. There's so many different working parts or so many different cogs in the system. And if you're not sort of all moving in the right direction, that cog system is not going to work. It's going to jam up somewhere.
Exactly.
And I think that's what it looks like from outside.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think, you know, the idea also, you put money into people's hands, they'll spend money. That's going to create small businesses that arise up
economy,
to create
yeah.
the services that mm-hmm. they'll need.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do it in a kind of centralized bureaucratic way.
No.
It just does it by people spending money on the things they need,
mm-hmm.
right? And then that's going to create the environment in which the businesses, the nonprofits also, that provide those services will have the resources.
So as we're sort of like closing down on our podcast today, and thank you very much for traveling up and taking the time to do this. We asked all candidates and incumbents if they wanted to come on Chamber Talk and share their views on why they're running. So I really do appreciate that. Is there anything that we didn't touch on or maybe that you would like to add for today just before we close the podcast or end the episode?
I guess I can just say that I've really been gratified by the conversations I've had with voters. It's really been a kind of humbling experience, in a sense, because, you know, I'm the first to admit that I've been kind of cosseted by academia and just, you know, having a kind of position where I just have to deal with sort of, you know, professors and relatively well-off students, you know, who've come to University of California, Irvine, and have a great future ahead of them, and not had to deal with kind of the broad public so much. And doing that has really been, really a learning experience for me. On the one hand, just understanding, I guess, the sophistication of the average voter, because, you know, I get into really complex conversations with mm-hmm. about these issues with people. And I find them much more invigorating and stimulating than conversations I've had with other professors, right? On the other hand, right, it's you know, I've had to sort of adjust my thinking and my policies and politics based on those discussions. So I guess I've come away with a real just having just entered into this political arena less than a year ago, a real respect for the political system that we have. I mean, we'll see how things go, but I really do believe that individual voters can make a difference.
So, David, we obviously all know how busy you're going to be if you are elected and you become the new congressman. But what's going to happen with David Pan if he doesn't? What are your plans just in case? What do you see yourself?
Well, I mean, it's not just about Congress.
Sure.
This is about this idea and about changing the way we relate to our government. And so I'm not going to stop with that. I'm going to continue to try and pursue it. I guess we'll see how things go. But you know, if the results are good, even if I don't win, then I can certainly consider doing another run in 2 years. But however it goes, I'm really committed to trying to, address these fundamental issues that our nation is facing in a serious way. And so hopefully that I can somehow contribute to that kind of effort.
I think you can.
Okay.
So thank you very much for coming on today, David.
Andy.
Really appreciate it. Thank you very much for watching Chamber Talk. And today we're with David Pan, who's actually running for Congress for the 46th District. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Good job. That was good.
Okay.